Oh, look, the camera angle. Look, wave. We're up there. That's neat, eh? Ben! Ben Armstrong. Welcome to the Channel 9 stage, my friend.
Good to be here.
You were here yet? Well, you weren't here yesterday. You were virtually here yesterday.
Yes, I was.
Because, believe it or not, you got plugged when I asked Jeffrey Stover and Jeff Woolsey which was their favorite sessions you should go off and see. They didn't mention you, but then Jeff threw out, but you really should go see Ben. And then magically you were here being streamed live on the Taste of Tech Ed stage. Welcome, my friend. What was your session yesterday on?
So yesterday I did the What's New in Hyper-V and Windows Server 2012 R2. Mm-hmm.
So it was a short session?
No, it was not. We have just a massive amount of stuff in this release.
Okay.
It's amazing how much we've managed to get into such a short release. So it's really fun to be up on stage and telling people about all the different features and all the new things that you can do with 2012 R2.
So I heard it was that basically overcapacity. They had to hold people off. And like, you know, there was like wristbands to get inside the room. It was so popular when they found out that Mr. Armstrong was going to be talking about stuff. But if you had to think, I know you're a little bit biased because you work on the engineering team, but what is your top three? And we'll talk about all the stuff, but you know, what would you say would be your top three? Three. What would it be? About Hyper-V 2012 R2.
Top three for Hyper-V 2012 R2. This is a tricky one. So I'm gonna go out. I will probably, if someone asks me this question tomorrow, I'll probably give a different
more succinct answer.
So not in order.
Okay.
So faster live migration using RDMA.
Yes.
This is just an awesome feature because what we're doing is we're actually doing live migration over SMB Direct. Mm-hmm. And the sort of performance we get is insane. So we've actually been able to demonstrate now live migration on 2012, where you would live migrate, you know, a virtual machine with 64 gig of RAM, and it would take 15 minutes. Do the same thing, 2012 R2, RDMA, 20 seconds.
Wow.
It is just insane. We're seeing, you know, performance improvements of 10x. And greater.
So I remember we saw that one there in the keynote. And so basically they did an example of one with nothing, and then one with the default, which is compression.
Yep.
And then one with RDMA. Now, just so our viewers understand, do you know what the requirements are? Like, how prevalent is RDMA in NICs and in server kind of setups these days? Is it in their garden variety NIC, or is it only a certain type of NICs? You have to have InfiniBand. Do you have to have 10 gig E? Like, you know, what's the scoop on RDMA?
So this is good question.
In layperson terms.
Yeah, this is a good question because the reality is RDMA hardware is still fairly new to the market.
Yeah.
So unless you've gone out and specifically sought RDMA hardware, you probably don't have it today. Mm-hmm. No, and that's where we built the faster live migration with compression so that people could get better performance with the hardware that they have.
Because that one, there's the default, right?
Yeah.
By default, go by compression, and then if it's available.
Yeah. So the default is live migration with compression. And our testing and expectation is even if you don't get new hardware, you put Server 2012 R2 on there, you can expect live migration to be twice as fast now, just with the hardware that you have. But what we're really encouraging people is, hey, if you want to just make the most awesome private cloud deployment where, you know, virtual machine mobility is just off the charts, you want to go out, you want to get the RDMA-enabled hardware.
Okay.
Now, you mentioned InfiniBand. That is one option. That's not the only option.
Okay.
So there are a number of standards out there for RDMA. Number of vendors with offering. There's Mellanox has their InfiniBand option. There's also Rocky and iWarp, which is going over Ethernet.
Okay. Yep.
So there are options there for whatever you're using in your server room or data center.
Just, you know, do your due diligence to make sure, obviously, the devices you're looking at are going to have properly certified drivers sort of stuff.
Absolutely, because I got to tell you, I did a demo where I demonstrated, like, here's doing a live migration over RDMA. Mm-hmm. I had the most awful time in the world getting that demo ready because I went through hardware after hardware where every adapter I was given was, like, the last firmware that did not support RDMA.
Okay.
No, I think I went through about three different network adapters until eventually I actually went to the file server team.
Yeah.
And I'm like, guys,
what's going on?
You have to give me the right hardware so I can demonstrate this at TechEd.
Nice.
And they gave me, you know,
to the file server team, they'll give me hardware too?
You can always try.
I can try?
Yeah.
I'm getting tired of lugging around my laptops, let me tell you. Okay, so that was number one. Now you got number two. Again, no specific order. Number two.
So number two. would be the guest clustering with shared VHDX feature.
Okay.
This is really cool. You know, and you have to understand the overall picture here. Mm-hmm. So today we're recommending, you know, if you want to do a private cloud deployment, your best story to get your best value storage in the picture is set up a highly available Windows file server talking to a shared storage space with a bunch of JBOD on the back end.
Yep.
That is your cheapest, best performance option. However, if you've been going down that path and you have some virtualized workloads that you need to cluster, in 2012, you'd had to do special case storage for those workloads. Mm-hmm. You would have your SMB storage for your standard virtual machines, but then for your clustered virtual machines, you would need to have iSCSI or Fiber Channel.
iSCSI would be probably the easiest one to do because you got the software-based iSCSI target if you wanted to, or you have the virtual HBA cards to go off and talk to
but
the real disk.
Then you have this problem that you have to special case and you have to treat those carefully.
Yeah.
In 2012 R2, what we actually do is, if you have highly available file server in your infrastructure, you can put VHDs on there, and we will actually then expose those as SAS disks into the virtual machine, and you get full clustering capabilities, enterprise grade, not dev test stuff, full clustering capability in your virtual machine, same commodity storage.
Wow.
No special casing.
And obviously they're protected by the whole fact that it's on scale file servers.
Exactly.
So if one node goes down, this still continues to work.
Exactly.
Wow. And how many can you do with that?
As
I think it's up to 64 or something like that.
You can do up to a 64 node cluster.
Yeah.
You can do up to, let me do the mental math, 255 shared VHDX files on a virtual machine.
Oh, wow. That's insane.
Actually, I'm wrong. You can 256 if you do the configuration right.
Okay. Nice.
If that's a limitation for you, please let me know.
Email ben.armstrong@microsoft.com with any problems.
So that's really exciting. The other thing that we're really looking forward to with that is now with the shared VHDX, it actually makes it really viable for people who are doing hosted virtual machines to offer guest clusters to their customers.
Yep.
Where today, that's just not an option. Mm-hmm. You know, and so we're looking forward to seeing what people do with that.
Okay. While we're in the topic, I know you're still on the hook for one more. We do have a question that came in here by iHeartPS. Nice name. Guest clustering with shared VHDX, since we're talking about that. Now, they're asking about, are you able to go off into live migrate the cluster nodes?
So they've actually asked a very detailed question.
I'm trying to simplify and break it down.
So there are some limitations around once you're using shared VHDX in a virtual machine. One of the key things we did want to make sure is that live migration does work.
Right. That's like a don't pass go, don't collect $200. If that doesn't work, then it does not make the feature set.
Exactly. On the Hyper-V team, we view live migration as table stakes. If we can't make a new feature work with live migration, then we don't do it. So even if you're doing shared VHDX, you can still live migrate the storage, the virtual machines around. However, the second part of the question here is, can the shared VHDX be live storage migrated? No, it can't.
Okay.
That is a limitation, something that we would love to not be a limitation.
Okay.
But
That's specifically within the hypervisor specific side of things for storage migration. Because you
correct.
Can obviously move the nodes
You can move the nodes. The reality is, the challenge that we have around storage migration here is we would have to do coordination between the two separate virtual machines.
Yep.
So the story, if you wanted to do a storage migration of a shared VHDX, what you're going to have to do is you're going to have to basically take down one of your cluster nodes, go over to a single node configuration, do the storage migration, and then bring the node back.
Okay.
Not elegant, but it is what it is, unfortunately.
Okay. So how about your third? We'll switch gears here and go back to your third favorite feature. And then we'll talk about more.
This is so hard because there are so many features.
It's part of the job of the interviewer, right? Make you distill it down, refine the answer to just the essence.
So the third one would have to be extended replication. This has been a huge ask. So we did Hyper-V replica in Server 2012.
Awesome feature. So simple to do.
Yeah, hugely popular feature. We had just lots of people deploying it, lots of great feedback. But of course, one, new feature. Mm-hmm. Two, lots of people using it. That means three, lots of feature requests. So we had a really hard time as we were working on R2 kind of prioritizing and going through the list easily the number one request we had around Hyper-V Replica was, okay, it's great that I can take my running virtual machine and I can have it replicated to a remote site and have it protected. But what I really want to do is I then want to replica it again.
Yep.
So this was actually really interesting to us because we had two very different scenarios came up. Mm-hmm. And the first one was actually quite surprising. You know, when we were first designing Replica, we kind of had it in our mind, like, yeah, people will want this. But we didn't understand why. Mm-hmm. So one of the things that we specifically built Replica for was we built Replica so that local hosters can offer it as a service. Mm-hmm. You know, we see this as a really important model. We want, you know, local hosters offering this as a service to small, medium businesses so that a company that's not large enough to have a recovery site can utilize a local hoster. Yep. We went out and we talked to a whole lot of hosters about this, and the most common response that we got was, you know, guys, we really like this Replica. We get where you're going. We get that this would be a great service offering. Mm-hmm. However, we're not going to offer it as a service because we're going to use it ourselves. Honestly, we had hoster after hoster after
hoster. A cheap and efficient way to be able to provide
exactly.
an extra layer of CYB, cover their butt, right?
Yeah, they were going like, no, I don't want to offer this as a service. I want to use it so that I can provide a higher level of guarantee to my users that their VMs are protected.
Okay.
And so that's where we came in. We built the extended replication. So now you can have your small, medium business running a virtual machine, Replica up to a hoster. The hoster is then doing an extended replication to their second data center to give you a higher level of protection.
Okay, I got it. So that was the three. Now, there was a question about, actually here from GG, since we're done the top three. We'll come back and talk some more. Will it be possible to use Windows Server Backup to back up virtual machines if they're located in SMB through file share? So we gave the ability to put the VHDX files on a SMB file share version 3 with 2012. We've improved upon performance and shared stuff like that with 2012 R2. Are we able to still go ahead and do backups against these guys?
So honestly, I don't know the answer to this specific question.
Okay.
But let me give a bit of detail and nuance here.
Mm-hmm.
So in 2012, we did a big push for enabling virtual machines on SMB3.
Right.
And honestly, if I'm talking to someone who's doing a private cloud deployment today, mm-hmm. my number one recommendation is I don't care what storage you're using on the back end. Obviously, I would prefer it to be Spaces, but I don't care what it is. Regardless of what storage you're using, you really want an SMB scale-out file server between Hyper-V and that storage.
So architecturally, you're just front-ending the existing storage. It's not a massive changeover.
Exactly.
It's simply front-ending the existing storage with SMB3 with scale-out file server.
Yeah. Even if you're using SANS or iSCSI, there is actually a lot of goodness that you'll get. You'll get better performance. You'll get better availability. You'll get better fault tolerance if you just put, you know, a scale-out file server mm-hmm. between Hyper-V and your storage. Now, because we made that push, one of the things that we knew going in was we need to have a solid backup story here. Now, prior to 2012, if you had something on an SMB share, we didn't have a backup story. So in 2012, we built in the functionality for remote VSS, where you can do, you know, the full Windows-style VSS backup on an SMB share.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in 2012, the Windows Server Backup tool that's included in Box does not take advantage of remote VSS. That's something that you need to get DPM for.
Okay.
Now, as far as I know, that hasn't changed in 2012 or 2. I may be wrong. I'm not the Windows Server Backup guy. So they own the you know, feature matrix there.
Mm-hmm. We just had another question come up here from Pierre asking, when we're using shared VHDX in the clustering scenario, for simply shared VHDX between two nodes that are clustered that are guests. Is this a failover scenario? Not a highly available scenario, meaning that the VM is going to restart any other node if something happens to the first node. So is it just like a traditional cluster, except there's now guests with a shared VHDX file?
The simple way to think about it is a cluster.
Right.
No, so it is everything. You know, if you had two physical boxes mm-hmm. clustered, everything that you would get there now in virtual machines.
Right.
Now, one of the really fun things, and this is something that we see people doing with guest clusters today, so we definitely expect to see this happening a lot more now that we have the shared VHDX, is We fully support, and in fact encourage you, you can do guest clusters on top of a physical Hyper-V cluster. So that's, you know, clusters on clusters, so it sounds a bit tricky. But the key thing to understand, and we built this in Windows Server 2012, is you can go into the Hyper-V cluster, find your cluster nodes, and you actually specify what we call an anti-affinity rule. An anti-affinity rule is basically where you say, these two virtual machines should never be on the same physical box. You know, because if they're part of a cluster...
It's like the gray matter kind of thing?
Yeah, pretty much. So what you do is you set up your Hyper-V cluster, then that gives you protection at the hardware layer. Then you go and you create a guest cluster, which is going to give you protection and high availability at the application layer inside the virtual machine. Mm-hmm. And in the Hyper-V cluster, you can go in and you can specify, hey, the nodes of this guest cluster should never be on the same physical hardware. That gives you just an amazing, you know, guarantee around availability of your workload.
Okay. Now, there has been some discussion going around here. I don't know if it's a big deal or not, but maybe we should clarify what this is. There have been some people asking about the differences between a Gen 1 and a Gen 2. Can you elaborate on that? Because that didn't come out in the keynote as like a big announcement. So, like, what exactly is the difference between a Gen 1 and a Gen 2?
So this is actually really fun. I talked about this in my session. And so a little bit of background here, and the story that I told in my session is when we started working on 2012 R2, mm-hmm. There were a couple of things that the Hyper-V team looked at. And one of the obvious things that we looked at was, okay, you know, private cloud. Shouldn't surprise you that we're thinking about private cloud.
Right.
You know, private cloud in 2012, Hyper-V, really great. What can we do in 2012 R2 to make it even better? Mm-hmm. So we've got a whole suite of features, you know, like the faster live migration, like the shared VHDX around private cloud. But we then also took some time to go, you know, putting all of this aside, what can we do to move the art of virtualization forward? Mm-hmm. You know, forgetting about, you know, the big pie in the sky stuff, like what's some cool technology that we can invest in to change the landscape here? And one of the things we came up with was the concept of the Generation 2 virtual machine. So let me step you through the details here.
Okay.
So you've used Hyper-V today.
I think I have, at least.
You think you have?
A couple times.
So I've been doing virtualization now for over 10 years. And when we started out doing virtualization in the late 90s, virtualization on an x86 platform was kind of this like strange, crazy idea. And most people weren't on board with the vision. So we had to go to great lengths to make our virtual machines look just like a physical computer, mm-hmm. so that all the various software would run in it. And the result is there's a lot of weird stuff if you go look in a virtual machine that's just there to make software work. So if you install Hyper-V today, create a virtual machine, install an operating system, open up Device Manager, and go in there and do some exploring, and you'll find lots of fun stuff. Like we have a PCI to a Pentium 2 processor bridge. We have an ISA bridge in there.
My goodness!
There's a whole bunch.
So it's
of
legacy stuff.
There's a whole bunch of legacy stuff that's
so it's,
there.
It's like the expanded version of the legacy adapter.
Exactly. So the Generation 2 virtual machine is where we said, can we make a virtual machine with none of this pretense, with none of this pretending to be a physical computer? Can we make a virtual machine that is just a virtual machine and trust that, you know, these days, Windows is designed with virtualization in mind. Windows is aware about this. Mm-hmm. So a Generation 2 virtual machine, what we actually have is it's a UEFI-based virtual machine which has none of those emulated devices. So interesting things about it, it can boot off of a virtual network adapter. We don't need legacy network adapters anymore. It can boot off of the SCSI controller. We don't need the IDE controller anymore. Mm-hmm. Interestingly enough, because it is UEFI based, we also get secure boot inside of virtual machine. Now, a couple of questions to answer here. The first one to be really clear about is does have a very limited set of guest operating systems we support.
Right.
So it only supports Windows 8, Windows Server 2012, 64-bit versions, and later.
Yeah.
Now, any earlier operating system, it's expecting that legacy cruft to work.
Right.
So it's not going to work on a generation 2 virtual machine.
Mm-hmm.
Another thing, and this is a very common question that I'm getting, is we have been very careful that, except for the things that I've just mentioned, secure boot, boot off SCSI, boot off virtual network adapter, we don't have any other features that are generation 2 only.
Okay.
You know, I've been talking about a lot of the new features and stuff, and I have a lot of people coming up and being like, hey, is this generation 2 only? I was no, it's generation 1, generation 2.
So that kind of answers, I think, Mike's question with the fact that, you know, shared VHDX, is it only supported on Gen 2, or is it Gen 2 and Gen 1?
Gen 2, Gen 1. The only features that are Gen 2 only are boot off virtual network adapter, boot off SCSI controller, and secure boot in a virtual machine.
Right. I guess some of the limitations would be that can only be created on a 2012 R2 host.
Can only be, yep, correct.
You're obviously, you can't have it created on a down-level version and migrated in.
Correct.
That's all fine there. Okay, that's
so,
not bad.
In this release, we're really encouraging people, like, go have a look at Generation 2 virtual machines, play with them, see if it works for your workload.
No, again, because I'm not blessed with the magic pixie dust to have access to the bits. You know, I have to wait for the public preview, which is coming out on June 26th, like everybody else. Is there like a difference with a Tiki Box and a wizard? You say, when I make a new virtual machine, say new Gen 1, Gen 2, or
you're,
is it?
You're psychic.
I'm trying to figure this out.
You absolutely nailed it. Yes, you go through the new virtual machine wizard, and fairly early on we ask you, hey, do you want a Generation 1 or a Generation 2 virtual machine?
Oh, okay. Oh, that's easy enough to do. Very easy to do. Okay, so we talked about three things. I put you on the spot for that. How about some interesting experiences you worked with so far now with people that are using 2012 R2 like in tap programs? Anything really cool to share there?
Yeah, so we've had some really...
Without disclosing
Without disclosing names, details, we've had some really fun experiences working on 2012 R2.
really fun experiences. I hope that's a good positive thing.
It is a good positive thing. My favorite thing, because this didn't happen once, this happened twice.
Okay.
In two different scenarios now, we have had people mistakenly come to us and think that our system was broken because live migration was too fast.
It's a good problem to have.
So when we actually had this happen internally.
Oh, yeah.
When we were first working on faster live migration, the dev team finished the work on the live migration with compression.
Yep.
We checked it in, we got it into the build. The very next day, we actually had to turn it off because we had a number of automated tests that broke because live migration was now too fast.
Oh, man.
And we had some tests where they were basically trying to start a bunch of live migrations and try and cancel them.
Right.
Just to confirm that live migration cancellation worked reliably. And they weren't able to cancel fast enough, and the live migrations were completing, and the test was failing.
Yeah.
So that was hilarious. And then when we started working on TAP program, we got people in to do some hands-on labs. We actually had a couple of people come up to us and be like, oh, I think the live migration failed because I started the live migration and then the virtual machine disappeared. And I was like, yes, that's because it happened.
Nice.
So that was pretty cool.
Gotta love that. We have a question from Kirk, but I know Kirk. He's up in Canada. Hey, Kirk, how's it going? I don't know if you're going to want to be able to answer that one there or not, because it's talking about Hyper-V on the Windows 8 client side, and I'm pretty well sure that we're keeping stuff on Windows 8 still under wraps until the build time frame, beyond what was inside the keynote. If you can just confirm or deny that you're not going to talk about that and we have to wait till build, because I don't want to put you in a bad spot.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Yeah.
I will give a vague answer. So that I will try and give Kirk the best answer I can without getting myself into trouble.
Right. I don't want any career limiting moves here.
Exactly. A key thing about Hyper-V on desktop is it's the same code base as Hyper-V on server. So 9 times out of 10, we do a new feature in Hyper-V on server. Yeah, it's going to appear on the desktop edition as well.
Okay.
There are, you know, features where, you know, it only makes sense on server, so we only do it on server. For instance, we only support live migration on server. We only support replica on server.
Yeah.
So obviously, fast live migration is only going to be on server because we only support live migration on server.
So let's leave it at that for now and say stay tuned for build.
Yep.
Great conference coming up. It's going to be lots of stuff. And also, sessions from that conference will also be streamed as well. Channel 9 team will be there capturing it as it happens. That's in there. We do have a good question. I haven't seen this one yet. This is, again, a little bit of my naivete. and not having access to bits, is emulated TPM. Is it available or not in the Hyper-V server?
So, no.
No,
that's the short answer. We do not have an emulated TPM as part of the Generation 2 virtual machine.
No problem.
The person who asked this, I would love to chat to them to understand why they're asking.
No problem. get a hold of Ben. Get a hold of us.
If you want to Twitter me, virtual PC guy, no spaces, no underscores.
Yeah.
Happy to follow up with you.
Nice. Now, Jeff suggested that we talk or do a quick little shout out about this thing that's called the Fast Track.
Yep.
Can you just kind of conceptually, because we covered a bit of the Fast Track at MMS, just from a conceptual interview process, had Brian Saras on stage, as well as the one of the architects that came up with the thing. But can you just kind of, in like 30 seconds or more, conceptually, what is a Fast Track, and what's the advantage of having something called a Fast Track for Microsoft products?
So the Fast Track program, and it's not Fast Track, Fast Track.
Fast Track. I need a
Australian.
Australian? I was about to say, you're not Kiwi, you're Australian. Sorry. That's like someone calling a Canadian American. I apologize. Oh, Canadian. I'm sorry. I'll stop. Go ahead. Fast Track.
Thank you. The concept behind the Fast Track program is if you're looking at doing a private cloud deployment, you know, you're new to this, and there's a lot of details to figure out, and you just want to get up and running quickly. We've worked fast.
You got it.
We've worked with the various storage and hardware vendors out there to establish some guidelines on, hey, what is a really good end-to-end hardware deployment for building a Microsoft private cloud? So you can go to our partners like Dell, Fujitsu, HP. You can go to them and say, hey, what's your Microsoft Fast Track offering? They're going to turn around and go, okay, here's the offering, and it is basically a single package where you get storage, network, compute, everything you need to do an awesome private cloud deployment ready to go.
So basically it's like I'll take a virtualization solution, small, medium, large, with the fries and a Coke kind of thing.
Exactly.
And that makes it simplifies the process of what different pieces you have to add in to be able to do it.
Exactly.
And I'm assuming it probably also comes with like consulting or professional services as
well. It comes
with
consulting, comes with all the right software. You know, if you are in a situation where you've been, you know, procrastinating on private cloud and you're running out of time, Fast Track is a great option because it allows you to go to your preferred hardware vendor, get the hardware quick, and know that this is going to be a rock-solid platform.
And so just for a quick little URL, if you just simply go and do a search with your favorite search engine for Microsoft Fast Track, all one word, no space, you'll be able to find the link off to that. It's inside the server and cloud area of the private cloud solutions on Microsoft page. It's easier just to do one of the search engine searches that's out there. We have about a minute to basically wrap this up. Do you have any closing thoughts that you wanted to share, my friend Ben?
Honestly, the only closing thought I have to share at this stage is I think we have covered 15%.
Right.
Maybe 20%.
I held them to 3 and as a list, a big list of stuff to cover. Your session is available on demand to be able to view.
Absolutely. So if this has been interesting, if you want to know more about what's new in Hyper-V and this release, please go check out the recording of my session. There is just a huge list of stuff that we've done, and we've only scratched the surface here. It's a fantastic release, and I'm really looking forward to when we get the bits out there and when people like you get to play with it and let us know how it's going.
Well, I'm looking forward to having access to the bits too, my friend. Ben, thank you very much for taking the time to come down to the Channel 9 stage here at TechEd to talk with us. I'm going to shoot you on back to the Taste of TechEd for the next session. Coming right out. See ya.